Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea and let's begin. Today's episode is hosted by Marion McConaughey.
Welcome to Herbcast. Today I'm talking to Claire Golding about endometriosis and natural ways we can help. Claire is a medical herbalist and aromatherapist who works one-to-one with clients both in her private clinic in Bristol and internationally via Napier's online clinic. Claire specialises in hormonal health and is a passionate advocate for menstrual cycle awareness. She also runs Learn Botanics Herbal Medicine Clinic and Workshops, which offer empowering courses and events in Bristol, the Southwest, and across Europe. Claire, welcome to Herbcast. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to us today.
Thanks, Marion. Pleasure to be here.
So we're talking about endometriosis today. It's a condition that can be painful and can severely impact on women's quality of life. It's thought that around 1 in 10 menstruating women suffer from it. So it can be a really big health problem. And it's sort of notoriously not very well treated. What first got you, Claire, personally interested in women's health generally and endometriosis specifically?
Yeah, I guess it was a personal one for me. I started having more problematic cycles in my late 20s to a point where I was having to take a few days off work and then having to sort of get caught out and plan things around. Getting caught out a lot and having debilitating cycles, a lot of pain, basically. So the things ramped up for me. Having to sort of go and sit down in the staff room and lie down and take sort of silent rest breaks and sort of grim and bear it type thing. And before training as a medical herbalist, my background was in aromatherapy, like you've mentioned. So I'd had a few tools in the toolkit in terms of things that I knew helped, but it wasn't really until my early 30s until things started really getting more impactful. And I started thinking a lot more seriously about what was going on and what was happening with my own cycles. So that took me on a bit of a journey to keep going back to the GP. And I experienced a lot of the, why don't you just take the pill? Are you on the coil? And I've done all of those things, numerous things. So yeah, it was a personal one for me that got me into thinking more about reproductive health. What is endometriosis? I definitely didn't know what that word meant until my early 30s. And yeah, going back and forward, and finally getting a specialist appointment. And I was lucky in that I really need to see a gynecologist, please give me a referral type thing. And I'm a real advocate and strongly believe in empowering my patients now about the kind of language to use to be able to get those referrals. But yeah, I was able to get the gold standard way of diagnosing endometriosis, which is the laparoscopy, which is under general anaesthetic, etc., and then doing the ablation surgery, which is where they take some of the endometrial cells that are out of where they should be. Mm. So I was able to get the diagnosis, and it was actually at the same time that I was in my first year of my degree at that time. So I was already on that journey of learning more deep dive into clinical, medical, biomedical and alternative practice and medicine, and thinking about the reproductive system and what that all meant. So I was on a bit of a professional and personal journey simultaneously.
Mm. Yeah, it often happens that way, doesn't it? I think. Yeah. Lots of the conversations I've been having, people are inspired by their own personal journey, which I guess also gives you a bit of an insight and to be able to communicate well with other people who are going through the same thing that you're going through.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what I see in my practice, I do manage, I guess I specialize a bit in pain management, and I know that area quite well myself. And but it's a constant humbling reminder that one person's pain versus another person's pain is completely different, and it's always very subjective, and you can observe and you can only really go from your own experience. But I think having a personal experience of that really does help that empathy level and that understanding, that deep understanding, when someone's like, yeah, it was kind of 5 out of 5, which is pretty top acute levels of debilitating. And I hear that a lot. So it does help. It does help having that personal understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is pain the main symptom that most people with endometriosis present with, and what are some of the other signs and symptoms that you might see?
Definitely pain is one of the top themes that circulates a lot. And I just quickly going back, I going more into the clinical side of things and specializing into this area of endometriosis, I did my undergrad thesis in pain management for endometriosis using Californian poppy. As a natural, looking at other pain management resources, basically. And so with that research, what really was prevalent is the opioid epidemic and how that's an ever-growing problem globally, and how addictive opioid-type cocodamol, codeine-type drugs are. And how, I mean, they can be very effective in acute periods, and I'm an advocate sometimes in the use of those kind of strong painkillers as well, I have to be honest. I work with biomedicine. I work with the allopathic medicine. I don't work against it. So yeah, pain management is really, really specific to each patient. And so for some, taking a paracetamol can just knock it. For others, it's taking, you know, codeine every 4 hours, etc. But part of my role, I guess, is looking at what we can do to reduce inflammation, what we can do to help the body overall to increase that parasympathetic state, so reduce that tension in the body, reduce that histamine response, etc. So yeah, pain is definitely a common theme when someone's coming to me for endometriosis. But you know, heavy bleeding is probably one of the other really, really common things I see. And I'm talking like wearing double pads and still flooding and worrying about going to work because of leaking through clothes and things like that. Those kind of levels of menorrhagia when it's really quite, you know, depleting in terms of your iron and you're losing a lot of blood. So the herbs can be a very effective way to correct that imbalance as well.
Mm.
But other key things are, yeah, that gut health issues is really common. And yeah, that's interestingly, from doing some deeper dive research, it's very much linked to maybe some of the latest research is pointing very directly at intestinal permanence issues. So there's strong issues with absorption. So again, the herbs can be very good at correcting the gut wall lining, helping with increasing tone, absorption, elimination. Anxiety, I guess, anxiety, nervous system disorders is always a common theme. There's such an element with endometriosis where there's an uncertainty. And I know this from personal experience. It's really kind of, you know, some people are like, no, 28 days, 7 days cycle, 2 days, I might be feeling a bit groggy, job done. And for some, it's very, very different kind of landscape. And I see a lot of that in other disorders, you know, other things like fibroids, PCOS, other gynae issues that I see a lot. There's always a little bit of an element of when am I going to bleed? When am I going to start feeling really quite, you know, rubbish? How much masking am I going to have to do, etc.? So anxiety and stress is a huge theme. So this is, again, such an amazing thing that the herbs can help bring the body down, reduce that tension and stress.
Yeah. And do people tend to come with you already with the endometriosis diagnosis, or are you sometimes seeing people who come with lots of the symptoms that you're like, I think this may be, but you know, without the sort of formal diagnosis, I can't tell? And does that affect how you treat them?
I do see, I attract the young people. I've got a lovely cohort of young, amazing young women that are in their like late teens, early 20s. I probably have high suspicions, estimated guess that they most likely do have that condition, but obviously legally not able to diagnose and wouldn't do that. So obviously always just refer on to going to the GP, get a good gynecology referral. But to be honest with you, we're very, very cute. We're in our world of biomedicine, and we love diagnosis. We love going to the doctor and getting something. And I understand that from a personal point of view. You know, it's quite a relief in a way. You experience a lot of ill health and chronic health, and a lot of chronic health stuff isn't able to be formally diagnosed. I mean, it isn't a little bit more when we're being a bit more nuanced with immunology and looking at the endocrine system and how these ill health, chronic health issues are happening. So, you know, endometriosis isn't technically a autoimmune disorder. However, there is a strong agreement in the science community that it does look and behave very much like an autoimmune disorder. So we see presentations of fatigue, low immunity, of gut health imbalance, diarrhea, constipation. Very much, very common is IBS and SIBO, leaky gut. So in a way, yes, it's helpful to have the diagnosis. It's helpful in a way that a patient's like, I've been to my gynae, I've had the laparoscopy, I've got the diagnosis, I've had the da-da-da-da-da. But it's not essential. What we're looking at, what I'm looking at is that person. You know, we're preaching to the converted perhaps a little bit. Well, we're talking whole person. We're looking at beyond their symptoms. I'm really interested in reducing symptoms and increasing quality of life, of course, right? So these are really primary outcomes. We want to help them live a happier life. And if they can be in less pain and feel happier and more calm, sleep better, and digestion is working, it's like top, that's primary. But really what we're looking at is the constitutional type and using the right and choosing the right herbs to support their constitutional type. So I get asked so many times, but what is the best herb for X? And it's such a hard one to answer, because I know we want reductionist quick answers. And yes, there are particular herbs that I would go to in the dispensary that I know would be effective for, say, heavy bleeding, for example. I'd use my astringent, really supportive, toning cardiovascular herbs. So yarrow is a real go-to for me for heavy bleeding, maybe shepherd's purse when there's really acute flooding and menorrhagia. But, you know, depending on that person's constitutional type, it might be a slightly different approach and herb depending what they're coming with.
What was the research that you found out about from your dissertation on Eschscholtzia or California poppy?
The most I decided to choose quite a difficult topic that didn't have a huge amount of clinical data, but there was a lot of the papers that I did found that was solid really pointed to how it can be really helpful with pain management when it's affecting sleep states and sleep latency. So when there's such the vicious cycle feedback loop between anxiety that's affecting the sleep, so preventing that person from falling into a sleep. The way that California poppy interacts is like GABA modulation and really high in alkaloids and berberine compounds, which help the body to, and you know, from a neurotransmitter point of view, the body is able to feel a state of calm. You know, obviously that's very reductionist and simplistically put, but it can be an extremely good anti-anxiety herb. but as a pain management herb, it can be really effective. And there was actually over-the-counter prescription in France that was licensed until I think maybe the last couple of years, which was the synergy between Crataegus, California poppy, and so hawthorn and California poppy in together. So really looking at more that anxiety, nervous system support. But interestingly, the research that I found, Jill Stainsbury in the States, she's done a lot of really excellent research, and there's a lot of rehab services that are using California poppy as part of that dopamine secession habitual pattern. So when you're looking at addictive tendencies and dopamine tendencies, California poppy is actually really effective in that decreasing that secession, which is ironic because it's, I sort of like to say, it's like opium poppy's safer younger cousin. It's the non-addictive, safe for children, used a lot in bedwetting and anxiety in little ones. Traditionally, it would have been chewed for toothache, so it has always been used as an analgesic.
Yeah.
But we use it more in tincture form and tea form.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because I've read that endometriosis is associated with lower levels of hormones like dopamine and melatonin. So it's interesting that Eschscholtzia sort of is helpful in that. And that's potentially why herbs like Vitex might be helpful, because it increases both melatonin and dopamine. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting connection.
Yeah, it is. And as we know, it's, I guess, part of the reason why I got so interested in this is just the stark lack of research that's going into, obviously, herbal medicine in general. You know, globally, we're doing okay. You know, locally, we could be doing a lot more in terms of research. I read recently that there's like 67% male-only studies versus, I can't remember the stats off of my head, I've got it written down. But yeah, 67 more male-only studies than female-only studies. Yeah, I mean, there's huge gender gaps, you know, and it wasn't until the late 90s that we even started using women in clinical trials for the get-go, and it wasn't legally formalized until the early noughties. That's a really small amount of time. That's 25 years ago. So,
yeah. Which is why we know so little.
Yeah. It's why we know so little, and it's what makes me feel like I'm in service and an advocate, really. And I feel so passionately that we need to be an advocate for people that can't speak loudly and advocate their own needs. And I think when you've been medically gaslit for a long time, which a lot of women do experience, it's the truth. And that's not always because that's not trying to spread hate or divide. That's just lack of knowledge. Sometimes the GP wouldn't know how to signpost and what the best place for that, you know, referral would be.
Yeah.
I'm a real advocate now of saying if you can get to like a pelvic pain physio, which I know there are in certain trusts, that's a really good additional support. I was lucky enough to speak at an NHS multidisciplinary kind of conference last year. So there was loads of endo specialist nurses and gynecologists there, and there was lots of different speakers within the NHS. So I was lucky to be able to go in as a private practitioner, as a herbalist, and talk about herbal treatment for endometriosis. And it was really well received. And generally, there was just a rhetoric of, we've got wait lists like 18 months plus, and we welcome how we can help our patients. You know, if we can just tell them to simmer some ginger for 15 minutes, and that's going to relieve some period pain because it's clinically been shown to be as effective as mefafanic acid. We know that.
Yeah.
So, and they were there, and it was amazing, really, to have that platform and to share that. And I felt very humbled to be able to advocate for that.
It's great that they put an event like that on and invited lots of diverse voices into it. Actually, that's encouraging that there's good things happening.
Good old Wales.
Yes.
Hi there, it's Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know that there are plenty more Herbal Insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. can check out some of our special sections, for example, our foraging area, showing you how to correctly identify and harvest wild species. And then in our recipes section, you can learn ways of turning them into some delicious and effective health solutions. And for the researchers amongst you, we have regular reviews of research articles dissecting the detail and bringing you the relevant insights. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
So, I mean, obviously endometriosis is quite, we've been talking about how it's quite poorly understood and treated. And there's lots of different theories about what's going on, you know, from alterations in enzymes that affect estrogen metabolism to kind of lower innate immunity. So natural killer cells can be low, as well as autoimmunity potentially going on. Can you tell us about any of the sort of theories behind endometriosis and why it occurs that you find helpful when you're thinking about how to approach the person in front of you?
Yeah. I think a little bit of myth busting is quite important here, because a lot of what you see in traditional texts or a quick AI search, which Google love to give you now, and you're suddenly an expert in 2 minutes, which is just not the case, unfortunately.
Mm.
One of the key things that you'll see is retrograde menstruation is a very strong theory behind that. And that's essentially some of the endometrial cells that are carried up the fallopian tubes in the blood during menstruation, they go the opposite direction, and then they come out through the other areas of the reproductive system, like the fallopian tubes and the other areas that surround the pelvic cavity. That is true, but it's also true to say that it occurs in most women, and the immune system is usually just clearing up that silently behind the scenes, and we don't know anything about it. So it's obviously shedding every month when we're not making a baby, and the womb isn't preparing for that. So we shed our uterus lining. That's what we do, and we bleed. So that's just one thing. I think it's important to mention that retrograde menstruation is very common, but in endometriosis there is an immune correlation, and it's an immune misfiring, let's say. Estrogen dominance is one of the key other areas that you'll hear and you'll read. Estrogen stimulates the endometriosis lesions. Estrogen does not cause endometriosis. Estrogen is part of that hormonal endocrine picture, that landscape, and it may be that someone with endometriosis does have raised estrogen in their bloods when they get their bloods analyzed, which I really advocate to do, but it's not the only cause. Obviously, one of the sort of more older theories, perhaps a little bit outdated but still relevant, is the Samson theory as well, which is again the retrograde menstruation, that the cells plant and grow outside the uterus, leading to pain and inflammation and fertility issues. The newer body of research, which I'm really interested in, and it's echoing the work of Lara Bryden, who's an amazing naturopath based out in New Zealand, is that, you know, from the latest research, it's very much to do with, as you were mentioning, the natural killer cells. It's an immune dysfunction disorder. And yes, we can agree it's an inflammatory disorder. So it causes inflammation that causes pain and higher histamine response, etc. But yeah, there's in immunology texts and papers, you hear again, it's a disease of the macrophage. So there's an issue there with higher iron and lower hypoxia, so low oxygen going on in the cells. Issue with clearance. So it's complex, it's multi-layered, and it's not a simplistic thing, and that's why it's a hard thing, I think, to get diagnosed one. But yeah, there is interesting links around genetics and epigenetics as well, potentially being exposed to toxins like dioxins, even from like your grandma's lineage, and that being passed down. It's just kind of fascinating and you know, a bit scary, but what can we do about that? We can just do correcting our body now But if we think about generationally, you know, it's an interesting thing to consider. But yeah, going back to the idea around and the theory and science around intestinal permeability, so there being an issue with the gut wall lining and how much there's issues around absorption and integrity there with the tissue.
Yeah, that would tie in with the immune stuff as well, wouldn't it? Because if you've got kind of permeable gut, then that'd be triggering the immune system to behave inappropriately. So do you use some of that immune knowledge to tailor your approach to people in terms of either diet and lifestyle or herbs that you might use?
Yeah, hugely. I think baseline is correct the gut function, strengthen the absorption, strengthen the function. There's really little point in taking very, very high grade, expensive supplements, etc., if your body isn't able to absorb all those amazing nutrient load. So we need to be really going back to basics and getting the diet a bit more strong. If they do take meat, I always advocate bone broth and probiotic sources, prebiotic probiotic sources. So yeah, a lot of gut support function, which isn't a way that we can, you know, start from base level. Another key thing is obviously, as I've mentioned, reduce impactful, debilitating things that are going on. So I might make up like a pre-ovulation, a post-ovulation mix, and a pain mix. Some patients, because if they're really feeling that after their ovulation into the luteal, when they shift from their summer into the autumn, if we're talking more from a cyclical menstrual cycle awareness perspective, then that's usually commonly when a lot of identifying women would experience more problems in their cycle, problems being mood disturbance, real drop in energy, real drop in motivation, feeling levels of sometimes quite, you know, high levels of anxiety, like debilitating. So some with PMDD on more extreme acute presentations, but also cramps that are, you know, affecting sleep and heavy bleeding when their cycle actually comes. So yeah, I'm thinking about the herbs and the approaches to help with limiting the impactful presentations. But yes, the immune modulating herbs is very key to my treatment plan approach. I would probably always be putting some nutritive, adaptogenic, lovely medicinal mushroom or maybe ashwagandha or reishi or one of those gorgeous adaptogen herbs as my baseline tonic in most of my prescriptions.
And that's pre and post ovulation in those two different mixes?
Most likely. But when we're thinking about the immune system, what does that mean? Is that they're really flush and they're really hot and they're really struggling to settle? They've got essentially lots of parasymptomatic excess type symptoms, maybe high blood pressure, maybe heart palpitations, lots of raised hyper conditions. So I'm looking at like draining that to help calm the body, to regulate that nervous system response. And then obviously when our nervous system and our stress is less, our immune system can have a bit of a chance to catch up on itself and maybe not get ill in as many times. And you're supporting the body's immune response with, you know, herbs that are helpful for white blood cell increase, stimulating herbs. So I use both the immune stimulating and modulating herbs, I guess, differently.
So what are some of the immune stimulating and modulating herbs that you use? Just a few examples of them.
Echinacea, I guess, would be one of the top stimulating herbs that has got some interesting research around with mast cell and macrophage and natural killer cell support, so supportive deeply to the immune system. Yeah, elderberry would fall into that category. Maybe rhodiola, maybe panax. In certain cases, depending on the levels of depletion, I wouldn't be giving panax to someone that's deeply, deeply on extremely low, tired to the like very extreme chronic fatigue level, or maybe I would in very small doses for a very small amount of time. But more the immune modulators, I mean, there's so many, but reishi, codonopsis, schizandra, astragalus.
Lots of those good adaptogenic ones, yeah.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I really love like lycium, like goji and those rumania. Very just, if there's issues with stagnation, which we usually always see in cases of endometriosis, it's always a little bit about liver support as a primary treatment goal. And how can we support the liver to function better? Because that's obviously our organ that's running around the clock, 24 hours a day, processing blood, processing hormones, processing lymphatic. It's just our, like, it's our just absolute hardworking organ. And if there's dysfunction there, and normally we are seeing imbalance and stagnation. So when the blood is very dark, we're very, you know, it's a very strong indicator that there's a liver imbalance there. And it's very common that we all generally have a bit of a liver imbalance, to make people aware that, you know, we look at the tongue, we look at the pulse, we have other like clinical and holistic ways that we would assess how the liver is functioning. But alteratives and liver support herbs are like fundamental in all of my treatments for endometriosis. So your burdock, your dandelion root, your schizandra, ashwagandha, incredible, yeah, milk thistle. We need to correct the liver, really, and that's a top aim.
Can you tell me about an interesting case that you've treated previously?
Yeah, I have got, I've got a patient that I'm still seeing. They came to me last summer, so I've been seeing them about just getting over to like 13, 14 months. And the patient came a little bit desperate, is a word I wouldn't use lightly, but they're just very tired of feeling rubbish. And English isn't their first language. I think advocating and the doctor has felt quite tricky for them. And is generally, as a person, a very, very stoic and very strong and very, very, very hardworking. And in that way, would endure a lot of pain levels. So when they came, they had very, very strong, heavy menstrual bleeding, very, very acute levels of pain every month with their cycle, and presenting with endometriosis, with fibroids, trying to conceive as a background sort of thing that they want to do at some point in the next few years, but deep, deep levels of fatigue that they'd fall asleep in at work, at breaks and in lectures. So working round the clock as a nurse, doing really long hours as a nurse in a hospital. I was quite shocked, really, if I'm honest, how unwell they were sometimes, and they'd explain how unwell they were when they had to go to work still. Just, yeah. So that was then the snapshot. And there are very, very large clots as well, like sometimes the size of their palm. So that's another area that we would look at in terms of deep levels of menorrhagia, deep levels of imbalance when there's that levels of clotting. And taking a very systematic mix of, well, she was on a main mix, a pain mix, and a tea, and they were all doing slightly different things and very, very disciplined at taking the herbs. And I use this case because it's quite incredible, it's not miraculous, but it's amazing to see their change in that they now can go during their menstruation without taking any painkillers, whereas before they were on a constant dose of ibuprofen, codeine, or paracetamol, or mefafenic acid, or tranexamic acid. You name it, they were on it. They've had the fibroid surgery, so I've supported some of that journey with the herbs, with helping with scar tissue healing, helping the body to remove and detox, etc., and repair from that surgery. So yeah, they're now not having any clotting, and they can menstruate without any painkillers, and the bleeding has dramatically reduced. They don't need to wear double pads anymore. They're just bleeding. It was still quite heavy, but nothing to that extent, and much, much much more energetic. Their reserves have increased, so they're much more bright and less deeply tired. So it's been a good journey to witness.
Wow, sounds great. And what sort of herbs were you giving in the different mixes? Just a couple from each mix.
So for the heavy bleeding for this patient, there was definitely capsella, shepherd's purse, achillea, yarrow, machicaria for the bloating and inflammation and general nervous system support. For a while, we had a specific main mix of thuja and some other really deeply astringent supportive herbs to support the size of the and the clearing of the fibroid. So there was licorice and white peony as a synergy in the mix as well. Mm. So, but we did change the mix throughout the months. She was on the same mix for like 3-4 months, and that was generally with the more nervous system, gentle, nutritive, adaptogenic support, just to help reduce that levels of symptomatic excess and heightened anxiety that she was her body was going through. And it's been a bit of a journey in terms of supporting the patient to educate and to guide that the body really needs to be in a place of calm to be able to ready to conceive. So those the areas of been really important to focus on, and background, there's a fertility theme as well going on in the mix.
Yeah, which I guess fertility is a big reason why, you know, going down the conventional route and taking contraceptives is often not possible for people who are suffering from endometriosis.
Yeah, I don't really specialize in fertility in my clinic. I'd usually refer on to colleagues that I know are in that more specialist field. But in terms of thinking about the body as it needs to be in a place of calm, and, you know, I really thank one of my tutors, I'm going to mention him, Carl Bedson, from my degree, who really took the learnings of Andrew Stapleford and developed the body of work that we looked at in advanced herbal therapeutics. And I mentioned symptomatic excess and parasymptomatic work, and really we're thinking about this so much as a primary area, as a constitutional type. And if the body is at a heightened excess point, then it's not going to be doing much except for fight or flight, cortisol, adrenaline, and levels of a deep adrenal fatigue. So
so focusing on that nervous system aspect as well is really important. Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation now. I was just wanted to ask whether there were any final pieces of advice that you would give to women suffering from endometriosis or herbalists treating them in terms of kind of key diet, lifestyle, or things to think about.
I'd say in terms of general lifestyle advice, I would be an advocate of looking into menstrual cycle awareness. I guess I've done some training with the Red School and as a menstruality mentor, and that work's been fantastic at underpinning and developing my practice. And that can be really, really simple things, like just kind of knowing where you are in your cycle and thinking about what your output is on that day of your cycle. And that can be immensely impactful in terms of how we go about in this world and having more leadership inside. A lot of self-care practices is huge in part of my treatment plan. And whether that's finding some way of connecting with your body, whether it's massage, whether it's yoga, whether it's walking in nature, whether it's walking barefoot, finding some self-soothing nervous system regulator is paramount. Yeah, I'm a big advocate in yoga nidra and the work of yoga nidra and how that is showing in our amazing clinical trials, how it affects our brain and our neurotransmitters, and how that just 10 to 20 minutes of stopping throughout the day and taking a rest and doing some breath work can massively impact us in terms of our stress and how we go about. But diet wise, you know, I'm a real strong advocate of high levels of protein, high levels of omega-3, lots and lots of, you know, all the obvious ones, like lots of fruit and veg, what I think is important to say is, if you're going to come see a herbalist, and we all work slightly differently, I really think it can't be too complicated from the get-go. Otherwise, I know myself, if there's too many things to do and change, you kind of end up just sidestepping and feeling a bit overwhelmed. So yes, it's kind of being disciplined to take some herbs and being on that journey, but simple things like just adding an avocado occasionally, adding some oily fish if you have meat or fish in your diet. Simple ways to life hack your diet and to do it in really accessible spoon-fed ways really, I think, shows like the ways that we can actually implement proper change. I'm interested in fasting, but very from a women's female anatomy perspective. So thinking about times to do that sensibly around your cycle. But yeah, if you're interested, yeah. Obviously, my practice is Learn Botanics and I run courses and bits and bobs, so do reach out.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Claire, for sharing all your knowledge. That advice all sounds sensible advice for everybody, but particularly yeah. Those who might have endometriosis. Thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure. Lovely to speak. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website, and of course on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care, and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.